From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. If you are a fan of Jurassic Park or How to Train Your Dragon, maybe a fan of Game of Thrones, you might have asked yourself whether a dragon could be real. From a DNA perspective, is it possible? Julie Knopfler thought about this when she was in middle school, and she got her dad involved. Her dad happens to be UC Davis genetics scientist Dr. Paul Knopfler. He has a lab, a blog, a few books, a TED Talk, and a lot of research to his credit, so he liked that challenge. Julie's now 17. She's about to start her senior year in high school, and the book they worked on together has just been published. It's titled How to Build a Dragon or Die Trying, a satirical look at cutting-edge science. Julie and her dad, Dr. Knopfler, came to the studio recently, and Julie started the story.
So I had a eighth grade like science project, and it was pretty casual. My teacher, she was pretty cool, and she kind of just let us like come up with whatever we wanted. I had read a lot of like fantasy books about dragons, watched TV shows, and I really liked dragons. So I was like, well, how to build a dragon? And I made like a little model of like what the dragon would look like. And that's pretty much how we started it. And then my dad was like, wow, we should make this into a bigger project.
Yeah, I think I followed as Julie was doing her project, and then the project was done. And then I didn't really want to let go of that idea. And so we were talking as we were walking our dog. We were talking as we were having dinner. And then I was like, this could actually be a book, you know?
Were you initially thinking about it on that sort of DNA cellular level?
Sort of. I was kind of more thinking about it in the bigger picture. And then my dad helped me kind of like find the tools to actually achieve like the like building process. Because I was thinking like, oh, what starter animals could like we use? What things could we add to the animals? I didn't like know how we would actually do it, like scientifically. And so my dad was like, yeah, we can use stem cells.
And then we started looking on the web and reading different books, and we realized there were a lot of really cool creatures already out there, including stuff already called dragons, like Komodo dragons and these things called Draco lizards, which I can't remember. Are they in Malaysia?
Just Southeast Asia.
And they're really tiny. Like Komodo dragons are huge, but these Draco lizards, I don't know, they might only weigh a few pounds, but they can kind of almost fly because they soar like a flying squirrel. So we were really getting into it and thinking, you know, what if you could cross those two and kind of get the giantness of the Komodo dragon, but the sort of flight of this Draco lizard. And then, you know, the science that's in my own lab, like using CRISPR, using stem cells more towards human health, we realized that might be able to come into play to engineer a new animal.
The pictures in the book, by the way, are beautiful and fascinating. Like there's a picture of a dragon hatching out of an egg that you look at it and you think,
yeah,
this actually could be real. Is it real? You find yourself wondering.
We also realized that picture came incidentally from someone who was just sort of imagining, you know, what a dragon inside an egg or hatching out might look like, or a dinosaur inside of an egg, like what would that embryo maybe look like? So we also realized other people had thought about, like, what if you could make a real dragon? And I think we both even found people who had kind of speculated about how would you make the fire? You know, how could you make them fly? Things like that. So we realized that, you know, this was our idea in a way, but also other people had had a similar idea.
But you think, what should the temperament of our dragon be? What should the gender be? What should the diet be? And what about the brain? How intelligent should this dragon be? And you really spent time thinking through the pros and cons and purposes of what would go into making a dragon.
Yeah. I think because it started out as like a conversation, we kind of brought up a lot of different topics over a long period of time. So we really like covered everything we could think of.
It seemed like in every case there was a trade-off. So
yeah,
if we didn't want our dragon to have the mind or personality to kill tons of people, we might end up, as we mentioned in the book, on too far on the other extreme, and they could just never do anything other than, you know, they might be peace-loving, sit around, you know, just playing games or something like that. So we were, you know, we were sort of like, do we get the fearsome dragon who kills people, or do we get a dragon who's sort of never does anything that's dragon-like or something in the middle. So everything seemed like a trade-off in that regard.
Yeah.
Chapter 3 is titled Fire, and I'm going to read just a few sentences. As amazing as it is, giving our dragon flight feels less daunting than the next item on our wish list, which, as far as we know, no living thing has ever been able to do, and that is to breathe fire. That whole chapter and that whole explanation is really fascinating. You do eventually get to methane gas.
Yeah, we thought a lot about the flight part, but then we realized the fire was really more of a challenge because there have been hundreds or thousands of things that fly. But again, like, what actually breathes fire?
And yeah.
We couldn't find even things that were very close. And the closest things we found were there's this beetle called the bombardier beetle that kind of has a chemical explosion out of its behind that, you know, it's the wrong direction, but it's like kind of almost like fire-like.
Yeah.
And then electric eels can emit electricity, kind of like a bolt of electricity, which is that sort of struck us as being a little bit like fire. Oddly enough, as it sounds, something akin to like a burp that you light on fire, you know, or gas that you light on fire was the best way to go that would actually maybe actually work.
Yeah, that was a fun chapter. I remember thinking like what could like fuel the fire that would be not like bulky. And I remember being like, wow, I guess like gas would work. And then like, because like animals make gas. And I think we both kind of like thought of that like independently and then kind of fused our ideas.
That's where the methane came into the picture.
Yeah.
Julie, tell me about your process with this. Your dad could probably off the top of his head spout a lot of answers to questions that came up. How invested and involved did you get in the research?
Well, my dad did tackle most of like the hard science stuff because that's just like his background and his expertise. But I really enjoyed doing stuff like the mythology part of it. Like we did research about what dragons look like in other cultures and like mermaids and other mythical creatures. And I kind of did that part, like most of it. And it was really fun to just learn about like different cultures and their like versions of dragons. And yeah, I just kind of helped more with like the big picture ideas. And then he kind of helped more with like how you would do it with the tools of science.
So CRISPR, the gene editing, was an important tool here because then you could kind of cut and paste existing DNA codes, correct? There was stem cell work. There's biochemistry work.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So do the tools exist the way it looks in this book to create a dragon?
I would say most of the tools exist in kind of a basic form, and they would have to probably be adapted in certain cases to get the end product of an actual dragon. But essentially, they're there. So the CRISPR gene editing, for instance, we could sort of change up the genes in a starting creature, like a big lizard, like a Komodo dragon or something like that. We could change genes that normally might give a bird wings. We could change those same genes or turn those genes on in a lizard to change its arms, for instance, into wings. And we go into a little bit of detail in the book, but there's a fair amount of science as to essentially like the genetic code that makes up a wing, for instance. And interestingly, a lot of those genes are the same things that give us arms, but they just sort of different combinations that give you a wing. So I think it is doable to make a creature that was in its natural state not having wings to actually make them have a wing. That's something that people have actually done in certain organisms in the lab. Like fruit flies, people have been able to make fruit flies that have no wings and also make fruit flies that have extra wings and things like that. So some of that is actually real. The stem cell part is pretty interesting because stem cells, it's thought that we can engineer new tissues and organs with those. So something like giving our dragons big horns or I think even those, the stem cell technology might contribute to the wing development, things like that too. Some of it is still fairly hypothetical, like some of the early embryo work. A lot of this we might have to do with maybe starting with lizard eggs or bird eggs or something like that. So some of the technology like to manipulate those eggs, maybe by putting stem cells or different genes into them. The technology is there, but I think we would have to do a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
And so that's something we mentioned in the book, too. Like, we would have to do a lot of sort of quote-unquote dragon research just to get to the point where we're sort of moving forward.
Did you become convinced, Julie, that a dragon could be built?
I think I was fairly realistic about it. I think even though, like, the science and the tools, like, theoretically exist because of, like, trial and error and, like, resources and the danger aspects, the ethical aspects, it kind of felt like it was pretty far-fetched, even if, like, hypothetically speaking, it might be possible.
Yeah, we talked a lot about that, and I think I can't speak for Julie, but my sense is we both sort of felt like someone could try it, and they might get partway through it, but I don't know if they could get to the end point where they have a happy, healthy dragon, and they're still alive, too, because
yeah.
We also realized going through the whole process that, and we mentioned this a lot in the book, like, there are many ways we could end up dead as we're trying to build this dragon, ranging from the dragon accidentally, you know, fire-breathing on us, or us riding on its back and dropping us out of the sky, to a Hindenburg kind of moment where, like, the dragon's full of gas, and instead of breathing fire, it just kind of explodes, you know, and we're standing right next to it.
You do, in almost every chapter, write, what could go wrong and how could we die? And you do answer that every time, and there's a possibility almost every step of the way.
Yeah, we took that pretty seriously, but also we found ourselves laughing a lot, I think,
yeah.
Imagining, you know, like being quote-unquote farted to death. Like if we get the dragon to make all the gas that it needs, but it can't, you know, ignite it, and it just fills our research lab with gas, and we all, that's the end, you know, or other things. So it was definitely on our mind. And then we were worried, too, about, obviously, it going out in, like, in a, you know, adventure movie and, like, pillaging the world.
Right.
You know, that came to mind, too.
We haven't talked about the satire, but that's definitely woven throughout. Do you want to give an example? And whose voice is that more? Or do you share that sense of satire?
I think we share it. My original one, I think I was extremely snarky, and so we really liked that, so we kind of, like, wove it into the whole book, and me and my dad are both kind of jokesters, so we kind of
added it in. Joke with each other a lot, too, and kind of poke fun at each other, but also just for me as a scientist, I see so much hype about science out there in the real
right.
world that I felt like as we were going through the book, it might be a handy opportunity to poke a little fun at my own field of science and how sometimes, like, stem cells get hyped and CRISPR gene editing gets hyped. Like, people think we can just cure every disease in the world with CRISPR or make designer babies and things like that. So I think there was a dose of satire from both of us as we were going through it. Yeah, there were some times we were kind of worried about various things that might happen. Like, people might take us seriously and think we're advocating going out and building a bunch of dragons right now. Or that we're too sort of satirical about science and not taking it seriously enough. I actually tweeted our book a few days ago, and someone seemed very seriously responded back that they were going to build a dragon. So that has also crossed our mind.
I think it would be a fabulous TV or video series. And you do bring up along the way, would this be like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein? Or would this be something, at one point you asked, that we need to start with the egg rather than the dragon? Where do we begin? I love what you did with the exploration of the science and, as you said, Julie, the mythology or the imagination, too.
Yeah, I think it was super important how we ended with the ethics, because I feel like you can read the whole book and get really excited about it and, like, kind of maybe a little bit unrealistic. And then I think we wanted to end with, like, we should really seriously consider, like, what we're doing and should we do it.
So, yeah. In the preface, you wrote, as we talked and then started writing, it became clear that the idea of making a real dragon would present many hypothetical ethical dilemmas. Dragons are monsters, after all, and these possible dilemmas started piling up and then became an entire chapter of the book. Please take the last chapter seriously.
Part of, I think, what went into that is in the world of CRISPR, there are a lot of really complicated ethical issues out there, like using CRISPR on human embryos to make an actual person with a genetic change, or using CRISPR to engineer new organisms that just DIY scientists, like in their garages, might release into the world. And they're really changing. You know, if you release a new CRISPR creature into the world, there are ethical questions about that.
Yeah.
And so we just felt like we were we were having fun throughout the whole book, but occasionally we would stop and have these more serious conversations. And so that kind of ended up building into a chapter.
Let me take you back, Julie. How'd that eighth grade project go over? What'd your classmates think about it?
Well, my teacher, like I said, she was pretty amazing. I don't think I've ever had a teacher who would have taken that seriously, but she was very, like, open to my weird project. The classmates thought it was entertaining, and they laughed a lot because I kind of was joking a lot through the whole project. But, yeah, they thought it was very hypothetical, and, you know, the other kids did, like, which is better, Coke or Pepsi, and, like, more like you could actually test it, and mine was extremely theoretical.
How to build a dragon.
Yeah. Didn't you have something like a science open house or something?
Yeah.
And some adults came by and like really enjoyed your project and laughed about it. And
yeah, I think the principal came by and she was like, yeah, I have never seen anything like this before.
You mentioned mermaids, and a really fun part near the end of the book is the question in that respect, how would you build a unicorn? There's a whole discussion of what the horn could be made of, how you could create a horn, and why it should be one substance other than the other. Did you end up having long conversations, for example, about a question like that? Was this real exploration at home?
We talked a lot about these things. So I would, for instance, on the question of building a unicorn horn, I would go and dig into the scientific literature and kind of educate myself, like what genes and what proteins go into giving an antelope a horn or something like that, and then come home and say, hey, Julie, we could actually do this. We could actually, for instance, start with a horse and give them a horn that is very much like what is depicted as a unicorn horn. And those horns are actually real things in the real world and other animals. So it may not be as hard as you think to make, of course, a non-magical unicorn.
All this way down the road then, Julie, and the book actually now being published, reflecting on where you've come from, what for you was the purpose of the bigger exercise, the writing of the book, and all of the time that the two of you put into this?
Well, I really enjoy writing in general. I have my own blog where I like just write about stuff just pretty regularly. So I just generally enjoy writing.
I did give her one nudge one time about writing a book about women in mythology.
Yeah, I'm actually doing I'm in art class and we do a thing called like an extended exploration. And I'm doing mine about like women in mythology. So I thought like part art, maybe part writing, some kind of project like that would be interesting.
It's not far-fetched to think that someday, Dr. Paul, your grandchild, Julie, maybe your child, will be discussing some reality about building a dragon.
I think it's possible.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah.
The book title is How to Build a Dragon or Die Trying. Its co-authors are Julie Knopfler and Dr. Paul Knopfler. Julie's blog is Juju Review, spelled J-U-J-U-R-E-V-U, and Dr. Paul's blog is The Niche. We'll continue this conversation about the ethics of genetic editing after a short break. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Gene editing with tools like CRISPR is a new and fast-moving frontier that we're only beginning to understand. The ethical questions are perhaps the most challenging. UC Davis professor of cell biology and genetic researcher Dr. Paul Knopfler addressed this in a book he co-wrote with his 17-year-old daughter, Julie. The book is titled How to Build a Dragon or Die Trying, and I asked him to say more about the importance of ethics.
Yeah, throughout my career, I've had more and more time to think about the ethical side of the kind of research that I'm doing and other labs are doing, and it's really become more important to me as a scientist that we consider the ethical issues. And that's part of the reason why, as my daughter and I were having fun with the idea of using CRISPR and other technology to build a dragon, the ethical side kept coming back and we ended up having a whole chapter on the ethics because there really are many questions.
Did you find that you had to really lay some of that foundation, the importance and the weight of the ethics, while the fun and the frontier of the technology allows such a vivid dance in the imagination?
That's a good way of putting it. There's a lot of imagination out there. There's a lot of people kind of dancing with different ideas about what we could do with CRISPR. And some of that is engineering new animals or engineering new plants. But some of the people who are most vocal about using CRISPR in new ways want to use it in people. And I think that's where you, at least for me, that's where we get more ethical challenges.
I'll go to the chapter that you wrote, and this is not about humans, this is about dragons, but some of the questions are, should we have done it? What kind of trouble did we get in along the way? Are we still alive? Have people been hurt? What about what we used in our research to create what we did? All of those deeply compelling questions. As you see governments and entities around the world facing the questions of DNA technology and gene editing, are they asking the right questions?
I think there are a lot of the right questions being asked, but it's sort of a process that's unfolded over the last 4 or 5 years. And more towards the beginning, I don't think we were asking the right questions. And now it's sort of become more real, in part because last year, a scientist in China actually used CRISPR in human embryos to make people. And so he generated twin girls who have deletions in their genome, so chunks of DNA missing, because he inserted CRISPR into these human embryos, implanted them in surrogate mothers, and made actual people. So that made many of us in the field realize that we didn't have a lot of time to sort of leisurely think about the ethical side of things. Here was someone making real people. And it's still timely because just recently it's thought that a third baby was born from the work that he did. And we don't know anything about that baby. We really don't know a whole lot about the twins who sort of quote unquote got CRISPR'd in terms of their health and things like that. And so it's been interesting and kind of scary in a way to watch the Chinese government try to figure out on the fly, how do we deal with a researcher who's made genetically modified people in our country? My understanding is he may still be under house arrest in China, but nobody seems to really know what his ultimate fate will be. So that, I think, made us all realize this is real. You know, this is not a hypothetical anymore.
Well, in February of 2019, the headline across the United States was, "New U.S. experiments aim to create gene-edited human embryos." So the United States is also involved in the same kind of technology. What's the discussion here domestically?
So here it's a little bit of a different situation because in China there was some, and there still is some sort of regulatory legal gray area as to whether making genetically modified people with CRISPR is okay or not. Is it legal or not? And in the U.S., at least at the moment, it's actually not legal to try to make a genetically modified person who has that modification in every cell in their body. So that legislation, I think it gets renewed every year. There's still some debate, I think, as to whether or not that will continue to be the case, that we cannot make CRISPR'd people, for lack of a better word, in the U.S. But right now, we still cannot. And so a lot of the research is just more basic lab research. People have gene-edited human embryos in the lab, but they have not been implanted. There's not really a reproductive intent in the near future, at least. But some of the research, there's sort of a caveat there because some of the researchers say they do want to do that in the future. That's why they're doing the basic research, is they actually do want to make heritable genetic changes in people in the future. Most of them are talking about trying to reverse mutations that cause serious diseases. So that is, you know, that's a honorable kind of goal, but it's just a question of is it going to be safe? There are alternatives like embryo screening, and there are also oftentimes societal issues that come up with this kind of science too.
In fact, with what you're saying, I know you know that this spring the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia talked about using some CRISPR-related treatments for cancer. And that it was actually used by two patients. Is that a completely different and completely as you said, honorable way to use this technology?
It is fundamentally different, I would say, because there, what's happening is researchers and doctors, they're changing, they're trying to deal with mutations in patients in certain kinds of cells, not within the reproductive cells of those patients. So, for instance, you might have a cancer patient. There's really nothing that anyone can do with today's technology, but using this gene editing technology, we can make designer versions of their own blood cells, their immune cells, to give back to them that will attack and destroy their cancer. And then basically the experiment's over. And so that patient is, the hope is that they're cured or they're put into long-term remission. And so we've really just made genetically modified forms of their blood cells. It's a one-time thing. Their children will not be affected by that, their grandchildren, et cetera. So it's not a heritable kind of thing.
It kind of runs parallel to the idea of a bone marrow transplant, where right. you're transplanting a healthier version of bone marrow after stripping out
exactly
the affected or the cancerous bone
marrow. It's just kind of like an enhanced bone marrow mm-hmm. transplant where you're making the cells, in an often case we use, not me personally, but the field uses a certain kind of immune cell called a T cell to go and attack the cancer. So you're doing like a bone marrow type of transplant, but you've designed the cells to be essentially assassins for the cancer.
I'm talking with UC Davis scientist Dr. Paul Knopfler, and we are discussing, among other things, CRISPR, which is a gene editing technology. And I mentioned governments looking at questions and ethics surrounding this. Where do you think this should be regulated? On the federal level, or, as is happening in California, a discussion of state regulations?
My sense is it's probably best to have federal regulations just because, for instance, in the U.S. with 50 different states, if every state has a different law related to gene editing, it's going to be very messy and you might have people moving from one state to another to try to avoid certain regulations. So I think having a federal regulation is probably the way to go, or guidelines like from the NIH, the FDA. That being said, we might even really need international cooperation on figuring out what is the best framework for dealing with the use of CRISPR in a heritable way in people. And that's something that's actually ongoing now. The first meetings along those international lines started in 2015. Unfortunately, as much as that discussion's been going on now for about 4 years, there's a lot of disagreement about how we should go about regulating heritable use of gene editing in people. On the one hand, I feel like we need, for instance, a temporary moratorium on implantation of CRISPRed embryos, human embryos. So I feel like we shouldn't go down the reproductive path. There are other people, for instance, this fellow in China who's already made gene-edited human babies who feel very differently, and they think that we should just forge ahead. We'll kind of figure things out along the way, and, you know, it'll be okay. And so there are, and then there's a bunch of people kind of in the middle who are, they feel like we need some kind of framework, some kind of regulations, but they don't quite know what's the, you know, a lot of people, a lot of scientists in the CRISPR area are just sort of shrugging their shoulders like, throwing their arms up, you know, how do we actually regulate this to encourage the good science, discourage the stuff that's really risky? And so we're sort of watching a regulatory experiment unfold right now.
How fast is the technology moving? How fast, for example, in your lab, is the experimentation changing?
It's a very rapidly evolving technology. So we started with CRISPR, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago in my lab, and already the things we were starting, the kinds of versions of CRISPR that we were using, they're already a little bit old-fashioned in a way. And so I think it's just been interesting to watch that technology go at warp speed. Unfortunately, again, the sort of ethical policy discussions, they're more like snail's pace. So there is a real kind of disconnect between the speed of the science and the speed of talking about, like, should we do this? How should we do this? When should we do this, and what other kind of questions should we ask? The other thing that's made it feel more urgent is some people have said the guy in China who made the CRISPR babies, it was just a one-time thing. But now we have another scientist in Russia who's saying, you know, heck, I want to do the same kind of thing too. I want to make CRISPRed babies as well. And in fact, as much as the guy in China was really condemned by the international scientific community, the guy in Russia said he wanted to do essentially the same thing. He wanted to target the same gene for the same purpose that so many people had criticized. So that got a lot of pushback, and now he has sort of shifted gears. He still wants to make, again, this is the guy in Russia, he still wants to make CRISPR babies, but he wants to try to prevent deafness, a certain form of genetic, a mutation-associated form of deafness now. So he's kind of abandoned, I think, the idea that the Chinese guy had, but the big picture, he still wants to make CRISPR babies. So this is not a one-time, one-country kind of thing, and I think there will probably be people in the U.S. who want to do this too.
CRISPR, in its simplest definition, has been the editing of genes. It's still the editing of genes. Is there something now that is out there on the horizon that's going to be the next thing we talk about in terms of genetic manipulation or DNA recreation?
Well, I think as we were talking, the CRISPR technology has evolved so fast that it's almost like it's just sort of like a relative of its former self. It's almost like a clone of itself, but a sort of 2.0 version. So it's the same thing, but it's really almost like a different thing in a way.
Can you give me
powerful
kind of a literal example of what that means?
Sure. Yeah. So when CRISPR started, we're trying to make certain mutations in a gene, like we might change a cancer causing mutation back to the normal version, and that worked pretty well. But oftentimes we would accidentally make other mutations in the same cells that we didn't want to make. So one way CRISPR has gotten so much better is that we still can make mistakes, but they're much rarer, and we understand why those mistakes happen somewhat better. So I think we have a more accurate technology, but we have a more, I think, realistic sense of how often the mistakes happen, things like that. So I think that's gotten better. And there are just other ways in which the sort of implementation, like the delivery of the CRISPR into cells, has gotten better. So I think there's a sense that that technology is going to continue to evolve. There are also things that are not really CRISPR, but they're CRISPR-like. And so there are other methods of making changes in the genome that are really precise, like a pinpoint change in the genome. It's not really CRISPR, but it was sort of inspired by CRISPR. And these things have other names like base editing and things like that. And those may or may not be better for certain kinds of applications. So I think, you know, in the old days, we had different kinds of technology to change DNA, and we thought those were wonderful. Then CRISPR came along. We realized that those were kind of clunky. They were expensive. So my guess is there's going to be something probably totally different than CRISPR that will come along in the next couple of years that will make us realize that CRISPR itself, you know, had more flaws than we realized. So I think there's a lot to sort of anticipate. Another area that's really cool is bringing together CRISPR with other technologies, like bringing CRISPR and stem cells together. That's going to be really powerful. So some of the most exciting work that's just going into clinical trials now actually is combining these really powerful stem cell technologies like blood stem cells with CRISPR and fixing mutant blood cells and giving them back to patients to cure them of things like immunodeficiency and things like that. So really exciting work. A lot of that's actually going on here in California too. This kind of work is really, again, it's going at warp speed. People may not necessarily build dragons, but they might build things like dragons. They might build a new version of a frog that they release into their backyard that they CRISPRed, and that frog is fertile and can go into the neighborhood pond and make other frogs just like it that glow in the dark or are 10 times bigger than a normal frog or things like that. So I also think we're going to have to closely watch the sort of DIY CRISPR world, because just in talking to people out there, there's a lot of people who want to play with CRISPR in their garages.
Yikes.
Yeah, yikes. But a lot of people think it's very exciting.
UC Davis professor of cell biology and the director of the Knopfler Lab, Dr. Paul Knopfler. You can find more information on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.